Hi, everybody. AJ Heitman here from GEMS, and this is the EMS Today Show. We have an interesting cast with us tonight. I would call it the Rat Pack of Trauma Care. I think when I added up the sum total of experience, myself included, we had like 180 years of experience on the screen, which is pretty frightening for me. First, we have Will Chaplot, who's been a paramedic for 41 years, trauma nurse specialist for 28. Last 5 years, he served as the director of performance improvement at American College of Surgeons after spending 6 years managing trauma training programs for the Committee on Trauma there. We have Greg Chapman, who is a paramedic, respiratory therapist, educator, has been involved in EMS since 1975. We're going to be talking about tactical care today, and I think it's appropriate. Greg's was responsible for the development of multiple editions, trauma and tactical C courses, serves on the board of advisors of the Committee for Tactical Emergency Casualty Care, charged with developing the standards. And Mike Hunter comes to us from the 37 years deputy chief for Worcester EMS in Mass and UMass Memorial Medical Center, and also functions as a tactical paramedic for WEMS and is assigned to the Massachusetts State Police Stop Team Medical Support Group. We have the ever-present Dr. Peter Pons, who's probably seen more trauma than we've all seen collectively, being at the Knife and Gun Club in Denver and at DG, and has been actively involved with pre-hospital care and disaster preparedness for over 40 years, and served on many national committees, serves as an educator, physician director of the Tactical Casualty Care Education Programs, Tactical Combat Casualty Care, Tactical Emergency Casualty Care, and Tactical Casualty Care for Law Enforcement and First Responders. And that's really where we're gonna try and zero in tonight on some of that stuff particularly. Lance Stuckey is a trauma surgeon at the famous Norman E. McSwain Spirit of Charity Trauma Center at University Medical Center. He's an associate professor of surgery at LSU, serves as the program director for LSU General Surgery Residency, member of the Committee of American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma, and serves on the State of Louisiana EMS Certifying Commission. And with all of that background, you couldn't get our guys into the Super Bowl, I can't believe it. And Lance, you know, you have to remind me to send you your induction into the Street Medicine Society, because that's kind of a closed group of docs who started out on the street. And I've got a real nice Street Medicine Society pen. It's something
that'd be great. Thank you.
It's something that Jim Page came to me one day and said, "Hey, we're starting a Street Medicine Society." And I said, "What?" He said, "Yep, it's going to be kind of a closed group for people that have started out on the street." And boy, when I go to meetings and I see an SMS pen, it really, you know, puts chills up me, because you know, a lot of, you know, the guys from Pittsburgh and all these other places really got their start there. And I really think that's the part of it, you know, for you guys to be involved in this all these years, it's really because you love medicine. Peter, we're gonna start off and ask you to describe for our viewers the Hartford Consensus, how it came about and what really it is.
Sure. Dr. Len Jacobs, a trauma surgeon in Hartford, was really profoundly affected by the shooting in Newtown. And he reviewed the autopsy results of all of those victims and felt that we really needed to improve our response to active shooter situations. So what he did is he hosted a meeting of participants that included law enforcement, fire rescue, EMS, medical responders, and military experts, with the goal being to discuss and try to put forth a recommendation on how we could improve the survival of victims from penetrating injury. And they made a recommendation, published a paper, and subsequently held three more meetings, each of which produced a subsequent paper on implementing and putting together a response to be able to improve that survival. Those are four documents that I would strongly urge everyone in both law enforcement and EMS to read and really take to heart the message that came out of those four publications.
Yeah, and I, in my capacity with GEMS, was really active in trying to get everybody to carry tourniquets again. And I really think the Hartford Consensus paper really put lit the fire under law enforcement to understand why they needed to have tourniquets on. And I think we've come a long way with that. So why don't you explain a little bit of how the papers have really changed our approach to active shooter incidents?
Sure. What they recommended was that, in fact, the traditional approach to one of these situations was a sequential response. Specifically, police would respond and secure the scene, deal with the shooter. Once it was declared safe, EMS would come in and deal with the victim. That could often take time. And obviously, a bleeding patient doesn't necessarily have that much time to deal with. So what they strongly urged was that, in fact, we should have a continuum of care, that continuum of care involves the response by law enforcement, not just for the criminal activity, but also for medical purposes. As they went through their meetings, they further expanded that to say that the uninjured civilian responder should also consider being a potential responder to really be the first one there, if at all possible, if the scene allowed. So what we've done is created a continuum of care now that includes the citizen, uninjured citizen, the police officer, then our standard first responders, fire, first responders, EMS, and then ultimately the trauma team at the receiving hospital.
And, I think it's just amazing that you can't really see a photo of a tactical team or anybody else without TQ all over them. And it never made any sense to me. I happened to be at an AMSE's meeting right when that plane crashed in Reno, and they had five really exceptional ambulances there, and they only had five tourniquets, one per trauma box, and they had 15 amputations when the plane careened into the crowd, and after that, everybody started carrying maybe 10, 15 tourniquets per ambulance. So sometimes disasters have to happen, like some of our active shooter situations, to spur things like law enforcement involvement. Now, Will, I'm going to ask you and Greg maybe to talk a little bit about tactical training. It's become very popular in EMS, and do you think it's appropriate for all EMS providers to go through tactical training?
If I may, let me build a little bit off of what the Hartford Consensus started in that regard. I think there were two mandates that came out of it. And I remember after the first Hartford Consensus, or when they were trying to pull it together, Dr. Jacobs had come to the college and said, there's a couple of things that are clear from what we're finding here. One is that our approach to the scene tactically is probably wrong, because people were dying while they were waiting, for the situation to neutralize itself. The second was that we needed to get the skills into the hands of the people who might be there when it happens, as well as to make sure all the responders were going to be trained. And what they described was basically the mandate that bleeding control be as commonly understood as CPR was. And that's basically an initiative that started off back in 2013, when this started, a year following Sandy Hook. And then subsequently through four meetings through 2016, to the point where we're getting closer to that. I think a lot still has to happen. But that was the mandate that came out of there, and that's kind of what they did. Better structured response and bleeding control being common knowledge. Now, directly to your question about tactical, tactical got very hot. Everybody wanted to do it. And I think on one extreme, what we've seen is that people turn every course into a tactical course because it's more fun. And on the other side, you have situations that maybe don't recognize how important it is to at least understand tactical situations. So you either extricate yourself or apply yourself based on your preparedness. And I think based on that, I would kick it to Greg, who was around, actually Peter too, but Greg was meeting with some of those first meetings that are trying to nationalize a standard for tactical response.
Okay, Greg.
Okay, so thanks, AJ. You know, one thing that I always think about is what's your definition of tactical? You know, I mean, some people will say tactical, you know, that'd be the medics attached to the SWAT team, you know, or ESU or whoever that would be. But really, a tactical environment is kind of defined as an austere environment. And, you know, to us, that's kind of operating outside of our normal capacities. You know, we're used to working in somebody's house, on a highway, at a car crash, or in our office in the back of the ambulance. We get outside that venue, whether it be a plane crash off the road, a snowmobile accident up in the Northeast in the wintertime, or, you know, a rescue out on a lake. We're outside the normal confines of what we consider normal operation, or we're in a tactical environment. So some tactical awareness and some tactical training at a level to make you think how you can function outside of normal everyday care is really appropriate. Now, if we define tactical as being attached to an operational police unit, then that's different. You know, there should be a limited number of people that are trained, and I'm sure Mike can back me up on this. You can't train everybody. You know, teams who implement good tactical medical programs have those medics involved in all their squad or tactical care with the police officers. You could possibly rotate everybody through that time and pull them off to work with that team. I think they're members of that tactical team. And, you know, that's truly important when we talk about doing tactical training. And truly tactical training isn't a 16-hour course or an 8-hour course. That might give you the overview of what's going on, but it's truly an integration into the team and preparing, you know, to manage those situations. And Mike, do you have anything to add to that?
Sure. So, I mean, just going right back to the direct question, I do think there's a benefit for everyone in EMS to get some exposure to the tactical environment, to take one of the tactical programs. If nothing else, is when you find yourself in that situation, you have a better understanding of what is happening with law enforcement, what's happening with the way we're taking care of patients. I mean, if you're on an ambulance expecting to go in the old way, as AJ talked about, and backboard everybody and remove them in a nice, safe, secure environment, it's probably not gonna happen. A lot of these mass shootings or mass casualty incidents that are ASHER events, you're gonna get patients that are literally gonna be dragged off the X, out of hot zones, in behind cover, and then, you know, moved out expeditiously to you. And it's not going to look like a typical trauma patient, and it's going to be on the fly. And what's done emergently in the first round of care, you also have to understand as the person that's going to actually receive that patient. The guys that are actually doing tactical EMS as part of SWAT teams or assigned to units, I mean, it also gets a little bit more involved because you have to have a basic understanding of the tactics of the team, how they work, the structure, and you have to have the trust of the team and the rapport with the team that you can maintain things like operational security, as well as do team medicine, because you have to know your guys and know what you're looking out for, know what each individual has for medical problems, what you've got to kind of be aware of, and, you know, really support the team both before the action, during and afterwards, to make sure that the guys are still and gals are still okay after the incident. So I do believe that tactical training is beneficial to everybody. If nothing else, it's just awareness and getting to see the other side of how things are done.
Yeah, and I think it carries over even into MCIs. I've seen people that have, you know, learned a lot of application medicine and situational awareness things become better at MCIs. But I really like to zero in a little bit on the police. And Lance, you probably see them coming in to the ER every day. And how do you think that their attitude has changed over time about their involvement with tourniquets and wound clot dressing and things like that?
I think the biggest change I've seen over the last 10 years is the police are no longer afraid of blood. They're not afraid to get their hands dirty. And 10, 15 years ago, that was not necessarily the case. And I can remember many scenes when I was a paramedic in the mid 90s where the police would stand around on the scene waiting for EMS to arrive, which could be 5, 10, 15 minutes. And they weren't intervening not because they didn't care, because they weren't trained to do it. And it wasn't even on their radar at the time. And thanks to the efforts of the Harvard Consensus, there is a brand new awareness on the part of the police on the critical role they play in early intervention. And we've had several lives saved here in New Orleans, and some have made the news, where the police intervened with a tourniquet prior to EMS arrival, and the patient walked out of the hospital. So I think they now recognize their critical role in this whole process.
Yeah, and I think the evolution initially came, I'll say, from trunk medicine to headrest medicine, where if you read the after action from Pima County when Gabby Giffords was shot, the Pima sheriffs were all given IFACs that they could have strapped to the back of their headrest. And it was told to them that, you know, these are for you and it could be for the public as well. And first of all, you could get injured, your coworkers, your other police officer could get injured. And when they rolled up on the Gabby Giffords incident, several of them grabbed their IFAC kits, and they were in the hot zone for quite a while, taking care of people, and were credited with saving a lot of lives. Mm-hmm. I have a story that I'm doing on a Pennsylvania State Police corporal that rolled up to assist a guy. And if you ever want to look it up on YouTube, it's PA State Trooper Saves Life with Tourniquet. It's pretty dramatic because the guy gets out of control and they wrestle him to the ground. He's out on the middle of an interstate. They drag him off the interstate, save his life. And then somehow he gets free and runs around, and in a split second, reaches inside the driver's window and comes out shooting and hit this corporal 3 times. He eventually, I won't go into too much of it, but he lost about 90% of his blood volume, the surgeons had told me. He was in and out of cardiac arrest. They had to make a go, no-go decision. The first thing he did was dive over a guardrail and put his own tourniquet on. And he didn't put it on tight enough. When the perpetrator left the scene, another trooper came over with his tourniquet and put that on him. But the interesting thing during the interview was he said, we were given IFAC kits, and I was told, put this in the car, and I understood the purpose behind it. He said, but then I went to a class with tactical medicine guys, and they said, no, you need to be carrying a tourniquet on your person, because you ain't never going to get to that tourniquet when you're shot out on the street. You got to have it on your belt. So that on the way home, he went on Amazon.com. His wife is a regular patrol officer, and he's a state trooper. And he ordered 2 and gave 1 to her and 1 to him. And sure enough, 4 weeks later, he gets shot and helps save his own life. And he said he never could have made it to his IFAC kit to be able to save his own life. So I think that's how things have evolved about trunk medicine versus IFAC kits, et cetera. And so now we're going into other areas, the medical training for non-medical personnel. So have you found that the law enforcement personnel can quickly grasp all of this using tourniquets, wound clot dressing, et cetera?
Absolutely. In fact, we just finished a comprehensive review with one of our local police departments. Excuse me. To review their experience with tourniquets. And we've got over 30 tourniquet applications. And the police officers, I think, really have engaged with this entire concept. Part of it is enlightened self-preservation for themselves, as you pointed out. Mm-hmm. And part of it is the realization that, in fact, while we think EMS gets to you quickly, that doesn't often happen. And they have a role. And they have really embraced that role very well. And the training is something that, quite frankly, they have participated in enthusiastically. at least our experience has been that here.
Yeah, and you know, I think, Lance, have you seen that with the Stop the Bleed programs, et cetera, that people that are coming into the ED have had some civilian involvement?
There is some civilian involvement. Here in my area, it's been primarily the police, but we do have some civilians that have placed tourniquets, some homemade with limited success, and a lot of commercially available, and they're available now in public places, which is a real bonus. You know, the goal is wherever there is an AED, there's also a tourniquet kit. And so that's, I know, a goal that's local here. It's also should be a nationwide goal. And so we are seeing more and more of it successfully used.
Yeah, and the old mentality of bringing all the disaster stuff on the rescue truck, that's kind of gone. When I was over in Paris and talked to them about the Barclavon shooting, they said that their whole philosophy changed at SAMU, because they literally had to walk up the street and throw tourniquets and other things to people as they went along the way. So they were carrying it all in one big bag, and now they carry a big red bag in every SAMU unit that has about 20 IFAC kits in it. So they could really just toss those out. Just amazing. And certainly learned a lot from the Las Vegas shooting as well, where people had to improvise a lot of things. So the civilians have come on board. And now we have civil disturbances have been so common of late. I couldn't believe what happened in DC. I watched it. I didn't realize from my vantage point sitting at my house that things were getting so out of control. It looked so orderly as people were going through the Capitol, and then all of a sudden all hell breaks loose. And, you know, I'm sure in this day and age that those kind of things, and I, for the life of me, you can't get me to explain what's going on in Portland. That's a whole other world there, but that's another situation. So civil disturbances have become a big part of it all. Now, in your programs, you have a couple of new programs. Who wants to tell me what they are?
Well, I can start with that. I guess the we've always had our group anyway. We've been looking at training law enforcement officers and citizens. And one of the things that came up, and actually was a request from one of our faculty that was doing training in the Denver area, that it would be a good idea to have a course for these types of events because of the proliferation of civil disturbances. So in a stable of courses that we're running, we've got the casualty care for civil disturbances, trauma care or tactical casualty care for law enforcement officers. We run these courses for those audiences for some of the things that we've been talking about here. You know, how do we take citizens? How do we take law enforcement officers? How do we prepare people for these events and for the types of things that they're going to face as they arise? The one we're going to do a Zoom course in a couple of weeks is a brand new course that we've piloted, but we're going to try online to see how it goes. But the idea with this course is, as these things occur, it's hazardous to the people that are responding, but it also is different types of injuries. When we had the trouble here in Chicago last summer, we had a police officer lose an eye because he was hit with a frozen water bottle. They were shooting fireworks directly at them. You talked about Portland, what happened in DC. The idea is, again, how do we prepare people that are responding to these things, but how do we prepare people who find themselves in them? Because it kind of develops around them. They never think it's going to be a problem till it is a problem. And that's what we were hoping to do. That was the start. Peter, and maybe you want to start there because you were there when the idea came that we should address it, or could we address it?
The request to have a educational program for civil disturbances actually originated with a former Denver paramedic who is now a police officer in a next door community. And they had their share of incidents following an unfortunate police interaction with somebody. And it involved sort of non-traditional wounding mechanisms that included things like lasers being shined at their eyes, excuse me, the fireworks, etc. So we thought that together, he and I and several others put together this program that addresses what are the common types of mechanisms of injury at civil disturbances, what things should a responding police officer be aware of and how to deal with it, you know, what things don't you have to worry about too much? He has now been teaching it at his location and well received by the officers where he is.
Yeah, and I worry about things because I have several people in my family that are involved in law enforcement. I worry about them being involved with fire, with Molotov cocktails, with burns, things like that, airway involvement. So is the program both didactic as well as hands-on?
Program is primarily didactic.
And that one can be. The one for law enforcement has more hands-on, correct?
Absolutely. I think the law enforcement course, if you're going to teach hemorrhage control, there has to be hands-on as part of that program.
And I do, I go down, I don't know if you've ever been to Strategic Operations in San Diego, but if you ever come here, it's in a former movie studio, and they train all the special operations forces as well as tactical in a real world environment. And during their didactic training, maybe every 15th or 20th slide, there's something that pops up that says the gentleman to your left, which might be Mike, let's say, has just been shot in his femur. And so they have to immediately pull their tourniquets out and take care of that person. And then they'll come up 15 slides later and says, the guy on your right just fell to the floor and he's been shot in the upper arm. Or then it'll say, you've been shot in the upper arm. And I really think, you know, by the time that you're done with an hour or two of those type of exposures, when you go out in the field, you really get to see what happens. And I get 21 paramedic students from Australia that come over every year, and I take them there, and they run a special program for them. And because they don't get a lot of trauma, they don't get a lot of shootings in Australia. And so these kids are like wide-eyed when they see all the amputations and simulations. And something that they taught me is one of their lead guys that brings them over, he makes the young kids, a male and female, before they're sent into a scenario, he makes them take a couple of laps. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So they get their blood pressure going and their pulse going. And then all of a sudden he'll say, all right, go around the corner. And they go around the corner and then bang, 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 bang. That's when all hell breaks loose. So I think that these kind of courses are just exceptional for people. And so when are you going to do the first civil disturbance course?
Well, that's coming up, AJ, February 13th. It's in about a week and a half. We initially planned it for, our initial date was actually for next weekend, and then we discovered that was Super Bowl weekend.
Oh, so
we
boy.
Anybody cares.
So, like, yeah. I
think we I don't care anymore.
but it's going to be February 13th. It's going to be at, God, don't quote me on this exactly, but I believe it's noontime Eastern, 1 Central, 2 Mountain, 3 Pacific.
Other way.
You're spinning a lot of direct people.
They can go on your website if they're interested and find it out.
The first lecture is time zone recognition.
Time zone management.
Time zone orientation. Right. But the program is going to be about 3 hours long. It's going to be taught by the faculty that you see here on the screen. It's going to go cover everything that we just talked about, plus other things like how to deal with simple things like with CN or CS gas in somebody's eyes, decontamination. You know, it's amazing what the protesters think of that all of a sudden will pop up. And as you said, Portland seems to be ground zero for these new innovations coming out. But super soakers filled with urine are common in Portland and Seattle right now. And I'm sure they'll pull away into other cities. And, you know, certainly we're dealing with these new changes. Every big protest, somebody will come up with something new that we have to adapt to and deal with. So it should be a fun 3 hours. It's 3 hours worth of CAPSE approved EMS credit. at successful completion of the exam at the end. And, you know, please join us. It's going to be a Zoom webinar.
Yeah, that's what's great about education today. I mean, I love doing live in front of the audience education, but boy, some of the conferences that I'm asked to speak at now, there could be 300 people in the room, and, you know, you can go to UMass today and it's a hard time to get a room that has 300 seats in it. So that really helps out a lot. So education wise, it's pretty good. I want to mention here a book that I ordered today on Amazon. It's called Unmasked, and it's Inside Antifa's Radical Plan to Destroy Democracy. And it's written by a gentleman who now had to flee the Portland area because everybody knows him and wants to take care of him. And he's up in Canada and in Great Britain. And apparently it's a really good book. It's already sold out, so it's on hold. But I think that's kind of a required reading. And then any other books and things that you would recommend to our viewers that they take a look at?
We mentioned the Hartford Consensus documents.
Yes.
I would urge everyone, if they can't get access to the journals, if they go to the stopthebleed.org website and click on the resource hub, they have put together a compendium of all the important points of the Hartford Consensus documents. And that is available freely. So I would strongly urge folks to go to stopthebleed.org and the resource hub, and it's there for them.
Yeah. And Peter, I think, you know, I would tell everybody to read those, but I'd first ask them to read who was involved in the Hartford Consensus, because that gives total credibility to it. It came at a point in our history where finally our government began to realize, hey, we better do something about it. And the FBI and other people were involved. And that really stirred the pot and got things down on paper and allowed for the Stop the Bleed program to get some White House attention, et cetera. So, it should be kind of a required reading. And you can Google it. There's enough summaries and reports out there that you can really enjoy it.
AJ, the other thing I should mention is that while the tactical courses and Hartford Consensus focus on active shooter and penetrating trauma, this applies to bleeding from any cause. It's not just active shooter. And the concepts are critical concepts for every trauma patient, regardless of etiology.
Well, speaking of bleeding from any cause, Lance, you have a little event coming up on Mardi Gras. And I know homicides are up all over the country, and it's going to be a different Mardi Gras this year because there's no parades really, but there's a lot of activity. I mean, the people of New Orleans are wonderful people. They're not going to stay home. They're going to be out partying, even if it's on their front porch. And I see that neighborhood homes now are decorated as floats. So I think it's really interesting. But losing the beads, I'm sure there'll be a lot of beads thrown and a lot of knife and gun club type of stuff. So are you doing anything special? What do you do to prepare for Mardi Gras?
So for a normal Mardi Gras, EMS has their, you know, it's challenging because you have the normal day-to-day 911 calls that occur regardless of the fact that it's Mardi Gras. So you have to have those units up and running just like you would any other day. And then Norman's EMS assigns units to the parade routes themselves, and they're spaced strategically along the parade route to rapidly respond to any event that happens on the parade. And common injuries at a parade are usually minor: falls off of ladders, broken ankles, broken arms, alcohol intoxication, things like that. The probably the biggest myth about Mardi Gras is that it's this wild, out of control party, which it is if you're downtown in the French Quarter, but the parade routes are 4 or 5 miles long and it's mainly a family event. So it's relatively safe throughout the entire parade route until you to get to certain parts of the route or downtown where it gets much busier. So the variety of EMS calls just depends on where you're at on the route. But certainly shootings spike on the weekend before Mardi Gras and through Mardi Gras Day itself. And so those units that are stationed on the parade route you know, we talked about mass casualty events earlier. They have to be ready to respond to a very chaotic situation on a moment's notice, having no idea how many victims they may have. And it's not uncommon every Mardi Gras to have one or two of these. I call them sort of a mini mass casualty event, where you may have four to six people shot on a parade route on any given time, but you have no idea what you're going into, and your response time is in the order of a minute or less, if not right away, because you're right there when it happens. So the EMS providers are under a tremendous amount of strain at Mardi Gras, and they're working essentially forced overtime. So, you know, outside of their regular schedule and their days off, they're also working 12 plus hours at a time. And so it gets intense, it's tiring, and they do a phenomenal job under really stressful circumstances. And then the crews that are stationed down in the French Quarter and down on Canal Street have a whole other level of intensity that you have to witness to believe it. But it's absolutely insane.
And a couple of years ago, they actually had a car run into the crowd. Am I right?
Yeah. And so it was and, you know, the terrifying thing about that. And I was actually riding in my parade that night. So I wasn't working. But we got the breaking news alerts on our phone that a car had plowed into a crowd. And this was about a month after the terrorist attack in Nice, France, where a guy had taken a truck and done the exact same thing, plowed through a crowd. And our first thoughts were sickening. We thought, this is a terrorist attack at Mardi Gras. We've been waiting for this to happen. And later, you know, that night we found out it was a drunk driver. And so then our reaction was, oh, thank goodness it's just a drunk driver, not a terrorist. It's pretty bad when you're happy that it's just a drunk driver and not a terrorist. But yeah, that was a big MCI at Mardi Gras. This was probably 3 years ago now. And then not 2 years ago, we had another incident with fewer patients involved of another driver hitting some folks on bicycles just off the parade route. And then last year, for the first time in a long time, we had two people on separate parades on separate nights run over by floats, which doesn't normally happen. Those were not MCIs, but they're fairly unusual events that get a lot of press.
Well, I had somebody tell me that, they're one of their in-services were playing some audio tapes so they could differentiate between fireworks and gunfire, because now that's one of the tactics that is being used in civil unrest, is that they're, you know, bringing all kinds of fireworks. I mean, personally, I don't care what the sound is, I'm hitting the deck. But I have a question of something that I'm not an operations director anymore, but if I was, this would be something that I'd be drilling on, and that is, when you have a civil unrest occurring, like a Portland, like a Seattle or whatever, where do you tell people to stage their ambulances? And do you have law enforcement with the ambulances to protect them? Because, you know, somebody could come and hijack an ambulance. Anybody want to address that for me?
Sure. I mean, I'm still out there with the operation side of the house. Yeah. A lot of it depends, AJ. Do you know that the event's going to happen? You know, do you have any intelligence that there actually is going to be a march, a gathering, a protest? Is it going to be mobile? Is it going to be stationary? And, you know, really, what's the intent? And that becomes a relationship with law enforcement and the other public safety within your community, that you have the trust that you can actually disclose and talk about that stuff behind closed doors to do your pre-planning. So like with everything, planning. The question staging, I mean, I think you should always have some type of security with your staging. I mean, it doesn't make sense to have all your assets in one parking lot and anybody able to walk in and eliminate that. So yeah, you definitely need to have some type of security. But you know, you might want to look at like a mobile deployment or run in parallel, which works fairly well. If you know where the march is going to go, you can kind of plan ahead and have your assets around the corner. It's like everything else with your stage, out of sight, out of mind, but be ready.
Yeah. And, I watched a lot of the footage from up in Seattle, and when they had the shooting, the one shooting, the Medic 1 unit would not respond in until police told them the scene was safe. And then, you know, they got harassed by a lot of the people that didn't want them there to begin with, that then they wanted them to go in. And, you know, it became a tense confrontation. They had to just say, we can't go in until the scene is safe. You know, you idiots made it unsafe and now you want us to go in there. So you're caught between a rock and a hard place. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, we have
one. You know, to Lance's point, Greg. To Lance's point, you also have to plan on the regular EMS. I mean, we had an unfortunate incident this summer with one of the protests in our community. It was pouring rain. The marchers marched down Main Street and there's a dollar store next to Main Street. And we had a citizen who came out of the dollar store, had a sudden cardiac arrest, basically beside the protest. And we had to get units in there. Luckily, there was enough police there that it was a successful resuscitation of the patient in cardiac arrest. But, you know, we weren't planning on that. We were all geared up and planning on something happening with the protesters. And now we've just got a citizen who happened to be in the wrong place, in her case, at the right time, because there are resources there. So you also have to kind of think ahead to all that. It's like, what ifs all the time, just what if everything to death.
See, AJ, that's a real good point that Mike brings up there. The in the East, some places on the East Coast in California and Chicago, in the Chicago area in the Midwest here, they've had very robust mutual aid systems that they use all the time. You know, that it's one of the things I've always stressed in disaster management, it has to be operational daily. You know, it can't be something you open up the box when things go wrong. It has to be something you use every day. And these systems that are in place in the Midwest and places on East and West Coast call up this piggy move-up operation. So forces are moving around all the time so that when you have an event like Mike described, you still have all your daily EMS stuff happen. Who's manning the stations? Who's doing the follow-up? Who's doing the backup? And whenever you see something big happen, in the Midwest here, I was chief of my department, but I was also chief of a division with 30 departments in it. And we would do these exercises. We deployed to New Orleans, for instance, after Katrina. Anytime you see something happening in these areas, all this move-up stuff is happening. All kinds of things are moving around that people don't know about. In order to do the things that we're talking about on this call, it has to be part of your daily operations in as much as you can still manage to adjust, because everything moves as soon as anything moves. And it's a really important part that a lot of people in some parts of the country haven't figured out yet.
Yeah, and you know, I do a lot of teaching, as you know, and one of the things that I talk about is where do you hide when things go south? And, you know, when I was a medic, I was told to hide behind the rim or the wheel of my ambulance, like their engine block, and that was going to save me. But one of the things we learned is you got to learn a little bit about the dynamics of a bullet. And one of the things that I did is I went to a state police lab where they fired high caliber weapons into their tanks. And if you watch the beginning of Saving Private Ryan, you see that the bullets that are hitting the water, some of them are killing soldiers and some of them are just look like duds. And that's because those rounds will not travel at high velocity more than 8 feet. And I'm like, you know, I don't understand that. And they showed me, and you could see it all over YouTube when they do tank shoots, that the bullet loses its density and begins to slow down within 8 feet. That's why the tanks are no longer than 8 feet. It's amazing. And so guess what's 8 feet wide? The engine company that you and I used to ride on has a tank that's 8 feet wide. So I have a new appreciation for hiding behind an engine. We can sacrifice an engine. I don't want to sacrifice my personnel. The other thing that bothers me is that I'll see a lot of people that are trained in tactical medicine and they gear up and they've got all of their vests on, but they don't wear helmets. Anybody want to address why tactical people need to have the helmets if they're going to be, you know, if they're going to be true tactical responders?
It doesn't make any sense. That's fashion over function, I think.
Well, I mean, you know, the one officer that got hit directly square here in Florida, in Orlando, that's what saved his life. The round hit him in the helmet, and thank God that he had it. So, I mean, that's just AJ being AJ, that, you know, don't be silly. Like you're saying, fashion over function is if you're gonna gear up and go in somewhere, for God's sakes, protect your head.
So I think, AJ, you got a key point. And I would take it a step further and say, you're not only protecting your head, but you should have some type of an eye shield on at the same time. And when you said helmet, I think we all stuttered because we were like, well, is he talking about Kevlar helmets or some type of ballistic helmet? Sure, they're really expensive. It's tough to outfit an entire department with them, but it's nice to have them. But at the very least, you need something for just what I call a bump helmet. You know, as you're moving around, you can go through doorways, hit your head, rocks being thrown, bricks being thrown, fire extinguishers. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's a lot of things that can happen that you really do need to have a helmet on when you're dealing with that type of a crowd, and the identification to know friend or foe as well. You know, tactical always seems to mean khaki pants and black shirts. But boy, that's really tough to be seen. And you really want to separate yourself in EMS. I think you want to separate yourself from EMS is to always be the good guy. You're not only there to take care of the police officers, but everyone else that's there.
Well, and you raise a good point, because a lot of the people that are going into these civil unrest situations to cause them are in khakis and are in, you know, black, and they're wearing face masks. We're all wearing face masks. That's important. And, you know, I just heard yesterday, maybe it was this morning, that the poor officer, God love him, that lost his life, the Capitol Police officer, the autopsy showed no blunt trauma on him. So yeah, there's some question now whether it really was a fire extinguisher that killed him, or whether it was a medical emergency. But three or four others lost their lives to cardiac arrest because they were out of shape when they went into that whole environment. So in a crowd like that, it's not like they're all warriors. There are some people were up in their 60s and 70s that were there. So things could really go south in a hurry right there.
I keep flashing on that kid that was stuck in the door. He looked like he was in good enough shape, you know, but how do you, the press of people in those hallways? I can't imagine being in that situation. That's worse than a lot of fires I've been in.
Yeah, and then, you know, I think the thing I want to close out on is a little bit about the emotional aspects, because we did have an officer that committed suicide after the Capitol incident, and we're going to have to debrief our people after incidents like that. Do you go into that in your training?
We do.
We talk about stress and rehab at the end of our class, and, you know, all these little events, every day-to-day thing and every call you go on is our peer support guys like to refer to it as a pebble in the backpack. And every time you do something or have an interaction, you put another pebble in the backpack. Some events end up being bigger stones, but when does that backpack become too heavy to carry? And that's what we look for, is to, like, how to identify what to watch out for. We don't try to talk about how to run a debrief, but we talk about the importance of debriefing and dealing with the stress and anxiety that these events and everything that we do comes into play.
Well, I talked to a firefighter from Seattle, and what stuck out in my mind is he said to me, you know, I've been doing this job a long time, but I've never seen so many people who hate us and want to hurt us. And he said, you know, our higher ups tell us it's not that they hate you, it's they hate what you represent. And so it's never safe. I mean, it used to be in the engagement of war, if you saw the cross on a soldier's helmet, you didn't pick him off. And then in Vietnam, we began to take away those crosses because snipers and others would want to take out the caregiver. So caregivers aren't safe. Anybody want to hit on that?
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, we look at things, you know, a little bit differently when we're working EMS, especially if you work in the urban environment. You know, one thing that I've noticed is that, you know, everybody is in a dangerous situation every night here in Charlotte. We're going into neighborhoods that we wouldn't drive our private car into at 2 o'clock in the morning, but we do it freely without thinking sometimes for, you know, a chest pain call or a shortness of breath call, but you don't know what necessarily is happening right around the corner. You know, our providers are you know, constantly putting themselves in those situations. And unfortunately, I think it becomes a little too routine sometimes that, you know, we hear some gunfire, but yet we don't react because it's normal to hear gunfire in certain large urban environments every single night. You know, we do put ourselves in that danger. And, you know, as Michael says, you know, there's a toll to be that we all pay at some point. And, you know, who knows whether it'll be early on in somebody's career or later on in somebody's career. We just never know when that all sort of adds up. And, you know, we end up in that, in those dangerous situations.
Well, I have a feeling that after we come out of COVID, that there's a lot of people that are scheming and dreaming out there, and that we're going to see more group gatherings and more, maybe, I don't want to call them active shooter situations, but I think there's a lot of people that have a lot of pent up frustration. So any EMS system, I think, should be prepared for that. Once people start hitting the town, it's going to be, I think it's going to be Dodge City. That's just my theory. Will, we're going to be doing these discussions with the group, with the Center for Pre-Hospital Medicine, frequently. You want to talk about some of the topics that we're going to be bringing up in the next couple of weeks?
We're working on, we want to bring some of the research to you. We've had some great discussions. And again, AJ, thanks for letting us do this. We really enjoy doing it. The work is important. It's kind of our nature to do these things, and you've given us a great opportunity. But we're working on pulling some of the research in for a in-depth discussion about TXA, for instance. And I think in a week or two, we should have that, be able to bring that forward, along with a discussion about pre-hospital ultrasound. So we wanted to go a little bit deeper than talking about it and why we think it's important, but actually showing you what the evidence is, that's kind of pointing the direction where these things are going to go in the future.
Yeah, and I would ask our viewers, we saw from the numbers from our first session that people really liked it. So hopefully some of you are repeat viewers, and it spreads as time goes on. But go to the International Pre-Hospital Medicine Institute site, learn about the courses, learn about the research. We're cross-pollinating. We're putting the research on GEMS, and you know, GEMS is driving traffic back there, because I'm a firm believer in research, and particularly with things like TXA. You know, I want our viewers to understand it. I want them to understand how systems have been implementing it. I want to understand the implications for rural areas where it's a longer distance to the hospital, and a little bit about what the aeromedical industry has been doing. And one of the things that we're going to be touching on with all of this stuff is, what did the military teach us? We've learned so much from our Afghanistan experience, et cetera, and double tourniquets per soldier. And, you know, we want to carry that out here. And unfortunately, we're carrying it out on the street. But I think all of us have in mind that what we're going to present to you can help keep you alive. Like we're talking about tonight, read the Hartford Consensus. I guarantee you there's things in there that you'll learn from, and help keep your patients alive. With that particular state trooper, it was a quick order off Amazon that saved his life, and he never would have been alive if he had to crawl back to his car. He never would have made it. So, you know, I want to thank you all for participating tonight. And as soon as we're prepared with the TXA, we'll do an advanced promotion of it, and we'll rejoin again. The Rat Pack is out for tonight. And thank you again very much. Have a good night.